The Guardian.
Hello, you're listening to Science Extra. I'm Alok Jha. This is the full interview with video game designer Richard Garriott. Best known for creating games such as Akalabeth, Ultima and Bioforge, Garriott's going to fly to the International Space Station in October. Ian Sample caught up with the soon-to-be spaceman and asked him why he's decided to make the journey.
I'm Richard Garriott, and I am about to become the sixth private citizen to go up onto the International Space Station with Space Adventures, a company I'm both a client of as well as one of the investors in.
And I can't help noticing you've changed out of the outfit that you're wearing when you turned up this morning. What were you wearing for those who are listening in, and what was all that about?
Well, I was wearing a flight suit. It's actually the flight suit that I'll also wear in space for when we do press activities in space or downlinks from space. And since my flight suit includes both the U.S. and British flags, I thought it would be appropriate to bring here to England for my press stops here.
Don't you feel a bit conspicuous walking around London in a space flight suit?
It's definitely a bit bright. It looks a little bit like Evel Knievel, in my red, white, and blue flight suit. But surprisingly, I didn't really notice too many stares. But it could be because in my life with the computer games, I'm also prone and well-known to run around in the costumes associated with my game, so maybe I'm just used to it.
What sort of things are you talking about? What are these costumes like?
Most of the games, or the largest volume of games that I've written, have been medieval fantasy games, and my character in those games has been called Lord British. And the fantasy world was Britannia, all in homage to my birth here in England. And so I have, like a Renaissance outfit, you might say, that I'll often go to computer shows as Lord British. And I'm sure I get plenty of stares then, too, but I've tuned them out over the last 30 years, so I don't think I notice anymore.
And what's the story behind that Lord British title? Where did that come from? And is this one of those nicknames you've embraced, unlike a lot of people who get school nicknames?
That's exactly how it is. And in fact, I was born here in Cambridge. In fact, Sunday, I went to see the house in which I was born. Sunday, I had the great pleasure to go actually visit Stephen Hawking and his daughter Lucy over in Cambridge. And it turns out about 2 miles from their house is the house in which I was born, so I went to visit it. But when I was in high school and the game Dungeons & Dragons first came out, my young friends thought I spoke with a British accent compared to a lot of the other Southerners in the United States, which, as you can probably tell, I don't really. But they gave me the nickname British, which eventually became Lord British. And since I really was born here and have dual citizenship, it stuck.
So most people will know you as a games developer. How did you end up in this position, knowing that in a few months' time you're going to be sat on top of Soyuz heading for the International Space Station?
That's also, I think, an interesting journey. It might seem unrelated, but in fact, my father was a NASA astronaut, and while I think every kid grows up, at least at some moment in their youth, believing or desiring to grow up to be an astronaut, when you live amongst astronauts, I think that desire gets into you a little deeper. But when I was young also, I had one of the NASA physicians come to me when I was a teenager and say, hey, Richard, I'm really sorry, but you're never going to be able to be selected as an astronaut because you have poor eyesight. Yeah. And at the time, that was would rule you out. But versus let that dispel me, I actually think that spurred me on. And I said, well, if I can't be selected as an astronaut, then I'm just going to have to figure out a way that private citizens can get themselves into space. And so I've been an investor in the privatization of space with almost all of my personal investing through my 30-year career in computer gaming. And so Space Adventures, the company that I'm flying with, is actually one of many of these privatization of space investments that I've made down through the years. But fortunately, this is the one that's actually taking me to space.
And your father, he flew on the shuttle and he flew on Skylab in the 80s. Now, did he not have a word with you and put you off?
Oh, not at all. In fact, our whole family grew up with with the activities around spaceflight being part of our daily life. And so I don't think it was any great surprise to my dad. In fact, he's helped me invest in a lot of these things down through the years, helped me analyze some of these investments. So he's known this has been a big passion of mine since I was quite young, and he's joined me now as my chief scientist and is helping me develop the experiments and things that I'll be taking to space.
And what kind of discussions have you had about this trip? He must be pretty excited about you heading up there And has he given you any tips? Has he said, look, you know, this is what it would be like? Has he had to do anything to calm your nerves?
No calming has been required. And interestingly, all the astronauts and other flyers that I have to speak to all kind of say the same thing, which is, you know, about the time you might think about getting nervous, which is pretty close to flight launch time, you know, when you're about to light that candle, so to speak, they say you get really so busy that you don't think about it. So we haven't really talked much about that. What we have talked about, though, is experiments and scheduling activities, because everything you do in space takes you considerably longer than it takes on the ground. And some things are harder than you might expect. Some things are easier than you might expect. And so that's really where he's given me the most advice, is to tell me how to help me plan my days to make sure I can accomplish all the things that I'd like to set out to do.
You use that phrase, light that candle, and that's obviously Tom Wolfe. And he was asking in that book, The Right Stuff, what does it take for someone to sit on top of a rocket and have someone light that candle? What do you think it does take?
Well, you know, I think it's really just, you know, takes a certain kind of spirit, you might say. And of course, from my vantage point, I'm accustomed to doing fairly extreme adventurous activities. You know, I've dug out canoed down the Amazon. I've been to Antarctica a couple of times hunting meteorites. I've been on safaris tracking mountain gorillas and other things in Africa. I've been to the seafloor with the Titanic and hydrothermal vents and even a deep sea salvage expedition. So I'm accustomed to these remote, somewhat dangerous, physically difficult activities. You know, space is kind of the pinnacle of those kinds of, you know, difficulty and arduousness, potentially, and even danger, of course. I think it's all, you know, quite measured, and so I feel quite safe. And from a physical taxing standpoint, you know, just a reasonably healthy individual can do this. There's no special requirements other than reasonable health that are required to pull it off. I think it's really just an adventurous spirit is the number one thing.
Can you pinpoint why you want to go into space? What is it? Is it about being there? Is it about the flight there and back? What is it about being in space that makes you want to do it?
Well, I think it's the same thing that has motivated me to do all of these terrestrial activities. I'm a big believer in, and I get my greatest joy in life from, you know, what I'll broadly describe as the exploration of reality. You know, the world we live in is vast. The areas of the world that we live in that are interesting are immense. And whether that's the seafloor, whether that's politics, whether that's philosophy, you know, whether that's the natural world, science, all those things interest me. And I think that's an interest that I really gained very deeply from, frankly, both my parents. My dad from what I'll call a hard science perspective, but my mother was always the Cub Scout den mother, and we would build things and explore the natural world and the socio world of cultural world, I should say, you know, extensively with her and through her.
What are you going to do when you're up there? I don't know how long you've got exactly, but when
about
you're
10
up
days.
There, okay.
And I have quite an extensive list of activities that include everything from commercial work that I'm actually trying to demonstrate that private individuals can go to space not just as a lark or as a vacation, as a tourist, but rather that we can also do not only scientifically relevant work, but frankly, businesses can be built in space that make it financially worthwhile to be in space. And as a non-governmental entity, I'm free to explore that fully. And so I'm doing some work, for example, protein crystal growth, which is both scientifically important and of great assistance to pharmaceutical companies to develop medications to combat a variety of diseases, but is also commercial in the sense of it's something that I'm doing about half of that work for fundamental research and about half of it as a commercial exercise that I'm selling those results to pharmaceutical companies who have paid in advance for their chemicals of their interest to be taken. I'm also doing a variety of what you might call conservation efforts, where, for example, my dad on Skylab had some of the first opportunities to do a photographic survey of the surface of the Earth. 35 years later, I'm going to go back and retake a lot of those same Earth observation photographs. so that we can compare how in one generation of space travel, the Earth has changed. And we're working with a lot of groups like the Nature Conservancy to help define what pictures would be, what shots would be the best and most relevant, and then how to also communicate that to the general public. Most interesting, especially for being here in England right now, is I'm working with schools and children around the globe, including here in England with the British National Space Center, to get school kids to provide questions and ideas for experiments, many of which I'm either going to answer from space, sometimes live with some ham radio downlinks, sometimes on video that I'll be recording for some of these experiments that the kids have proposed. And then return that and hopefully inspire another generation of interest in science and technology.
I mean, how important do you think human spaceflight is for inspiring up-and-coming scientists? I mean, it's a particular issue for us in the UK. As you probably know, our government doesn't support human spaceflight, and it's something that the government's reviewing at the moment. But one of the arguments for it seems to be the aspirational aspect of it.
Yeah. And, first, even to back up slightly from that, I'm a devout believer that education is the solution to most all of life's problems. And whether you're talking about, economic hardship or political strife or religious strife or global warming, almost all of those issues, I believe, can be solved with a well-educated populace. Mm. And I do believe that human spaceflight is one of the most inspirational things you can do to encourage kids to participate in science and technology. But I also believe, though, that that human spaceflight, if it's worth investing in for the hard-earned gold of a country, you do need to be able to show fairly measurably how this is rewarding the taxpayers. And I think it's the proper responsibility of governments to invest wisely out of the tax revenues of their populace.
Take me through your training. Have you been spending a lot of time in Star City?
I spend almost all of my time in Star City and have since January. And
what's it like for people who have no idea what it's what's the place like, and what do you actually get to do training wise?
Yeah, it's a fascinating place to be, because of course Russia is on the whole a very fascinating place right now, in the sense of as it's retooling itself. Downtown Moscow is an incredibly vibrant, rapidly changing, very interesting place to be. Star City, where I'm training, is interesting in a different way. It's a military base. It's a not very long ago super secret military base, and so it has not seen the changes nearly so much as downtown Moscow. So it's almost like camping out in the wilderness there, where you have this strange dichotomy of the simulators and hydro lab and centrifuges are all the most high-tech, deluxe, best equipment you can possibly manage. However, the funding for infrastructure around those items is largely absent. And so, you go to stores or things nearby, and you have a real hard time finding supplies to make very basic things like macaroni and cheese, or even college food kid, college dorm food, basically. Mm. So it's a really interesting dichotomy. But the training has been fascinating, too, where I started first in classroom work with textbooks and had to take oral examinations to make sure I understood the radios and life support and all the other systems. Then I began practical work, where I would actually work with those systems. And now I'm finally into what they call full simulation, where I'll sit down with my actual crewmates in a simulator and use all the systems at the same time to run through the exact procedures of launch or landing, including malfunctions that they simulate, to make sure that in case anything goes wrong in the real flight, we'll know exactly what to do as it happens.
How do you cope language-wise?
Well, the for launch and reentry, which is when there's most of this activity, that's completely in Russian. Mm. And so I've been taking about 4 hours a day of Russian classes also since January. It's one of those things where some of the private individuals who've flown in space have opted to really try to learn Russian to participate as fully as possible during that during those periods of time. And others have said, the commander does the most work, the flight engineer does the second most work, and the right seat, which is nominally reserved for what they refer to the cosmonaut researcher, is not normally a pilot. Even so, of course, a lot of our private flyers are not, but even when they send a Russian, they're not. And so it's possible to work in the right seat with a fairly minimal mastery of Russian.
So how's your Russian accent coming on? Do you want to give us a...
My Russian is «Нет хорошо, не много».
Sounds quite
not
convincing.
Very good, it's just a little bit. But I'm doing all right. And I have a Russian tutor. In addition to my daily classes, I've actually hired myself a Russian tutor because I've just to appreciate the experience and participate as fully as possible.
You could probably get a job as a bomb villain with an accent. They teach you the operational stuff, which I was quite interested in. Your button pushing.
Absolutely.
But presumably when you're up there, you will not be allowed near any of the...
Yes, and so the ISS partners who get asked a lot about, are we endangering our investment in this thing by allowing these private flyers up there? The Russians are very quick to point out that there are no operations that they are relying upon us as private flyers to perform. The safety and security of the operation of the International Space Station is in the hands of the professionals who train not just for 1 year but usually about 5 years before they fly. However, if we're on board the same vehicle, it's important for us to know exactly how and why everything operates, just so that in case something begins to operate anomalously, we can help troubleshoot it, and we know who to call, and we know how to rectify it in case it really does. We happen to be the nearest person to the fire, and we know where the fire extinguisher is, and we know how to turn it on. Versus stand there and yell help. Plus also they want to make sure that we are very self-sufficient. So, for example, when it comes time to talk with schools on the ground, for example, they don't want to have to send somebody over to set up the radios and get them all tuned in and set it up, because that takes time away from their jobs also. And so, self-reliance and the ability to deal with emergency situations, make it such that we're trained really on every system. I'm proud to say that, in all the tests I've taken so far, which I've passed handily, the trainers and engineers have all said, hey, Richard, you've got this down really well. Versus sit in the right seat, why don't you kick your friend out of the left seat and go fly as a flight engineer? So, maybe they're just talking me up. But, I feel like I understand and the operations quite well.
It was one of the issues I was keen to ask you about is whether there are people in the industry who are cautious about private tourists, or for the want of a better word, going up to the ISS, maybe not because of their inability to do all of the operational work, but almost more of the psychological side, and presumably the vetting isn't as severe as it will be for an astronaut, and presumably under certain circumstances the psychological demand on the people up there could be quite high, and you need to make sure someone isn't going to flip out and cause problems within, have like an air rage incident on the ISS. And this, I wonder, are there people in the industry who are cautious about this kind of thing?
Well, I'm sure if you look at the industry broadly, I'm sure you will find somebody, of course, who represents that perspective.
Sure.
I think it's worth pointing out that from a medical analysis standpoint that includes psychological profiling but also includes the rest of your medical history and appropriateness or preparedness for these journeys, we actually use the same contractors NASA uses and the same vetting process that all the other International Space Station partners use to make that determination. So I think any of the professionals involved actually well understand that these private flyers have been through the same formal vetting process that anybody else has.
Now, Soyuz has had some recent issues with landing difficulties. How closely are you following that, and does that make you anxious at all? Do you know what the state of play with that is?
So, of course, as you might guess, I follow it very closely because it's a safety issue. And as you've mentioned, the Soyuz has flown 103 or 104 times, all with a perfect track record of safety. So that's So as from a statistics standpoint, if you're going to go to space, which is inherently has some risks compared to a lot of other things you do in life, the Soyuz is very, very safe way to go. That being said, the last two reentries have been what are described as ballistic reentries versus a controlled reentry. And they think they understand how and why that has occurred, and they're making modifications to address that. And so because they're modifying even the vehicle that's in space now that I will be returning to the Earth in, you kind of want to know what they're doing to make sure you don't that you feel better versus worse about those results. So I am following it quite closely. A couple key things are, which is one, as I'm following it, I do believe they're doing a very good job in vetting the issues and correcting those issues. But it's also worth noting that even if they don't correct any of the issues, that's one of the beauties of the Soyuz, is that a lot of people think of the Soyuz as this old space vehicle that was designed 30, 35 years ago and hasn't really changed. That's what I thought before I started training. But in fact, that's not true. Mm-hmm. The airframe is largely identical, but every instrument on board or every device, if either it has shown a weakness through that history or there's just been a new modernization which would provide a great advantage, they've changed it out. However, if something has worked perfectly, there's no need or reason to change it, they've left it alone. And so there are things like some oxygen flow valves. You look at them and you go like, oh, I can tell that was made decades ago. But it's a simple valve, and if you change the valve out, you'll have to go retest it again, and inherently you're introducing some. So it'd actually be riskier to change it than just to leave it alone.
It's tried and tested,
and it's a little heavier than maybe a modern one might be, but that little bit of mass is not important enough for the risk of changing it. On the other hand, the cockpit is a completely modern glass cockpit like you would see in any modern airplane. And so, the whole cabin is filled with this interesting mix. And the result of that is that there are backups to backups to backups to backups throughout this machine. And a great example of that is like the radios. So there's you have your primary VHF radios that you use to communicate with the ground. But even when it was designed, they made backups. So there's a backup radio. And the backup radio has two modes, duplex or simplex, so there's actually a backup to that. And then they have a downlink for data that can be converted to voice if you really need it, so there's another backup. And then, when you get down on the ground, one of the things you do is you want to call home and say, hey, come pick us up. And so they made another little portable radio that you can take outside and hook up to antennas. So if your antennas break off, you can stick on an exterior antenna, or if the antennas work, you can just hook up this radio, or you can take the antenna and the radio and go outside. And then they've actually found that one time they landed in a little divot in the ground or a little low spot over the vast tracts of the land. And so therefore their line of sight that they needed for the radio didn't work. And so then they put in an Iridium telephone, a satellite telephone, just a commercially available satellite phone, and a GPS so you can tell them where the phone is. So there's this whole cascade of backups that every time they've had any kind of issue, they add another layer of backup.
What is the problem with the Soyuz as far as, I was reading a bit about it, suggesting that if you go ballistic trajectory down, this is the return trip, you can experience something like 9G, I think. Whereas if you steer it, you can bring that down to around 4G.
Right.
But has the problem been that they have just been hitting the 9G ballistic trajectory, or is there some other issue in getting the thing, in having it spinning or something, which is causing a greater problem than?
So here's the nature of this issue. So it's important to point out that the capsule is shaped like a teardrop, basically.
Yeah.
But the center of mass is slightly off-center to where you can actually, like a stone skipping on the water, you can slightly steer this device as it re-enters the atmosphere. And that's by steering, that's how you can kind of keep those G loads minimized. However, if on board since you have that steering ability, in theory, if you wanted to, you could turn it upside down and steer it steeper and actually go higher than a ballistic, higher G loads than even a ballistic reentry, which would be bad because you actually can take it up, hypothetically to fatal levels of Gs.
Right.
And so what a ballistic reentry is it says, in case either the computers or you, if you take over manual control, if you steer it in a way that it goes, I don't trust you anymore, it instead puts it into a little corkscrew. And that averages this ballistic reentry path so that you can't make it steeper and you can't make it lighter. And in each of the last two reentries, during the reentry phase, the computer has decided that I don't trust that I have control enough to steer reliably enough to give you that minimal G path. And so put it into this ballistic mode. And they think they understand how and why, and they've made some corrections, like they had a spacewalk here recently, and they've also changed out some software on board. And I've actually studied that in some detail at this point, and I believe there's good odds they've rectified it. But even if they haven't, you know, there's a ballistic reentry used to be only one model of Soyuz back was the only reentry.
Yeah.
It's the standard reentry. The steering method is a new method that happens to have not worked in the last two times.
How well do you get to know the other people that you'll be flying with, the crew? I don't know whether they train you all as a team to kind of help you bond, if you like, or do you get to know these people? I think a lot of people may think that someone going up privately will be sort of something of an outsider.
And I would have worried about that too. In fact, I did worry about that. When I arrived, I wondered the exact same thing, is how would they look at me? Would they see me as an intrusion? As defocusing them from their hard work, or at worst, even a risk, a life threat, to have a loose cannon on board, with them, so to speak. But in fact, I found it's quite the opposite. All of the astronauts and cosmonauts have completely embraced me and my predecessors. They are, they're also excited to get the, they know how special and rare it is to get a chance to go into space. And they're going they're just so happy for you that you get the chance to share that journey. A lot of them also, the private flyer just before me was a guy named Charles Simone, one of the developers, one of the founders of Microsoft and the developer of Excel and Word. So, all the other cosmonauts and astronauts know him, if you know what I mean, by virtue of they all use his products. And in my case, lots of the astronauts and cosmonauts and the trainers are gamers. A lot of them know of me. The few people who managed to, afford this trip are in many ways of some interest or curiosity, even to the other astronauts and cosmonauts as well.
So NASA marks its 50th anniversary this year. And I wonder if when you look at what NASA's achieved, that makes you very optimistic about what private space industry could achieve. And also, what does it make you feel, where do you think private space industry will be when it's marking its 50th anniversary?
Oh, God.
What is possible? Is it going to be, do you think private industry will be confined to suborbital and orbital? Or do you think there is more to play for?
Oh, I think there's definitely more to play for. But suborbital and orbital might be as far as we get in 50 years. Or at least, I actually think that, for example, with Space Adventures, we have a circumlunar mission that I think we'll be able to do too. But landing on another planet privately, whether we get that in 50 years or not, is an interesting test. That might be a bit pushing it a bit hard for that period for that time marker. But I'm a big believer that if you look at the evolution of exploration at other points in history, for example, tall ships crossing the oceans. The first, in fact, I'll be launching on Columbus Day. So, if you think about Columbus, crossing the Atlantic, that was funded by government, Spain. And a lot of the very earliest explorations were funded by governments because, of course, when you really have no idea what's on the other side and you have no idea if it's even of value, it's really only the political will of a taxpaying base that has the fortitude and capability to pull that off. However, once you've been there, done that, it quickly moves from being in the purview of governments to being in the purview of private corporations and also private individuals. If you look back again at tall ships, not only there were companies like the West India Team Tea Company that began to build their mighty fleets to travel around the world, but you also saw what I'll broadly call gentlemen explorers who would often mount sizable expeditions to travel to the New World, often for an interesting combination of adventure, but they would also take naturalists and scientists to bring back scientific value, and they would also take along the tools for commercialization. They would be looking for whether it was gold or new plants or whatever things of value they could think of to bring back to their homeland in order to build new businesses. And that, I believe, is the era we are now moving into with private space travel, is that I believe that much more than just what I'll call, what it often is referred to as tourists, and not that there's anything wrong with that. I actually think if you want to pay your money and go look out the window, that's just fine. But I actually believe that there is much more that civilian space travel can provide that is important and will be also commercially valuable in space in the near future.
How long do you think it's going to be before this kind of private space travel is truly affordable? And I don't know what figure that might be, but say, I don't know, £10,000 a shot, something
like
that.
Yeah, so that, unfortunately, that is not soon. But here's kind of the markers that I put into it. First of all, to go suborbital, I actually think will become relatively inexpensive relatively quickly, when I'm talking about the measure of a decade or two. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I believe that is that even if you look at, say, Spaceship One that Bert Rutan flew, the prototype, cost $40 million bucks or so to develop. But if you look at just the engine, the motor they put in the back of it that they can pull out and put in a new one, that motor you can go buy full of fuel for about $30,000 US. And so you look at that and go, that's the real cost of that flight. Well, that's not so bad. If you were just paying your share of that fee, which is ultimately what you ought to be paying for the Senate kind of thing, that is actually affordable. That's a first class seat, plane ride. The problem is when you go to orbit, that the amount of energy it requires to get to orbit compared to going suborbital, which is straight up and straight down, you have to carry a lot more fuel, you have to carry heat shields, parachutes, and all this other stuff, to where the cost immediately jumps into the millions of dollars. And I actually don't foresee a way for space capsule style launches to come into the sub-millions. However, there are, in a much further timeline, and now I'm talking 50 years kind of time frame, there are ideas on the table, whether it's space elevators that are using geosynchronous satellites and nanotube ropes that come all the way to the ground, and then a laser-powered elevator climber to climb up that rope. Well, obviously, that's a extremely unknown possibility. But if it works, and mathematically it should, and usually when something works mathematically, they eventually manage to find a way to make it work. Mm. And so eventually, it sounds like that might actually work. And that would make access even to orbit quite cheap. But that's a ways off.
What are the sort of the key practical hurdles in getting widespread space travel? I mean, is it purely economics and the small numbers of people that will be able to afford it, or are there actually practical sort of physical barriers in developing the kit, or even issues over sort of FAA, CAA, just sort of aviation rules in terms of governing the toing and froing of these kinds of things in and out the atmosphere?
Well, so I think the what I'll call the regulatory problems, those would be solved. If we had the other issues solved, I think that would find a way to clear itself. Just like I think it is actually for the suborbital stuff, you already see regulatory groups of clearing those boundaries. Space does provide some interesting challenges that will remain challenges for a long time. Like, for example, your radiation exposure is higher. The life support demands, are extreme and really need to operate, reliably. And, already if you fly on an airplane at high altitude, there's already quite a bit of things involved in the way evacuation slides and oxygen masks work. But you have to push that to a considerably higher level if you're going to go to space. But I think those are all actually still solvable, too. I really think the biggest issue, the number one issue, is energy. And energy, as you know, on our planet is actually becoming more difficult and more expensive than cheaper. And in fact, that's to a large degree why, if you look at the cost even for our own clients and myself to go to orbit, energy costs are a big chunk of what we're paying to be able to take this trip. And so that's why it really does need that's where the breakthrough needs to take place, is how do you avoid hauling all your fuel up with you in a rocket, and then requiring this massively heavy heat shield to return, which of course means you need to take more fuel to haul that heat shield. Once that problem is solved, I actually think everything else will be relatively easy.
Okay. Just interested in the role that private space industry might be able to have on subsidizing national programs. The Russians take advertising or have done, obviously they take paying customers. Do you think NASA should be allowing advertising or allowing people to pay for the ride?
Well, what's interesting is the short answer is yes, but the political reality is I can't imagine it happening anytime soon. But I think Russia has, by need, necessity being the mother of invention, has found a very powerful mechanism that actually doesn't just happen in space travel. They also do it with their deep sea work, which I've also done. For example, they have this great scientific research vessel known as the Keldysh that has these two submarines, the Mir 1 and Mir 2. They go down to places like Titanic and hydrothermal vents and these other activities, many of which I've done. But with the fall of the Soviet Union, funding for science basically went to zero. Mm. And a lot of this fleet was just abandoned and disappeared. But it was one of the visionaries in Russia and one of the partners, actually one of our partners in Space Adventures, vision. They got together and had this vision of saying, well, look, you're scientists, you have this great tool, you have scientists who want to go out in the ocean and take samples. Well, if you just allow us to take a couple of paying passengers from the United States along, you not only can subsidize your science, but you will also build evangelists for the Russian science program. And I think it's a great model because fundamental research is actually a very politically difficult thing to find funding for, because it's often inobvious what the direct connection is to value to the taxpayer. Mm. And so by allowing voluntary taxation for the privilege to be a part of the research expedition, I think that is a fantastic model for all countries that Russia has just happened to uncover first. Mm. And so I think it's a great model, and I think that for any country that's struggling with budgets, which all do, it's one they should consider.
How do you think NASA should be feeling looking back on their 50 years of existence? Do you think they should be feeling proud of themselves, or how do you view it? How does it look like?
I think there's no question that aviation and aerospace, at NASA at 50 have done a fantastic job. And so I think retrospectively they should be quite proud. I think going forward they have some very interesting challenges. I'd say the biggest challenge is what I'll call is to try to have an unwavering vision for the future. Because one of the biggest problems I think they face is that since going any next step is a multi-decade step, and when political regimes change out every 4 years, finding a plan that you can get the public behind that's sustainable for a couple of decades is, I think, going to prove to be really quite a challenge. Mm.
So finally, when you're on the top of Soyuz, sat on the launch pad in a few months' time, what do you think is going to be going through your mind?
That's a good question. I've talked with a lot of my predecessors about issues like this, because a lot of times people wonder, are you going to be scared, or how's it going to feel during those final moments? And most everybody actually has told me that those last few hours before launch are so busy. You have so many things pressing on your mind to keep track of and perform well, that you're really just caught up in the moment of performing. You don't spend much time, especially becoming concerned. Most people have not actually been concerned. Mm. I think most people have described how you really have to be conscious of the fact that you want to take it all in. You just want to remember it. You want to appreciate the moment. But you really have to be conscious and put effort into doing that.
Well, look, good luck, and I hope you have a very good trip up there and a safe trip back down.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to it.
That was the Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample talking to Richard Garriott. For all the latest science and technology news, remember to download the Guardian Science Weekly podcast every Monday at guardian.co.uk/science.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.